RCR with Paul Brennan.
It's about time we caught up with New Zealand First MP Shane Jones, Minister for Oceans and Fisheries, Minister for Regional Development, Resources, Associate Minister of Finance. Been a guest on our program many times now. He's in the Solomon Islands, and I don't know what he's doing there. In fact, I'll ask him. Hi, Shane. Thanks for coming back on RCR. You're in the Solomons. Why?
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity to chat with you again. Every 3 years, we allocate a sum of $100 million to get better outcomes for the Pacific Fisheries Nations. There is a huge conference coming up in June, July, and New Zealand obviously shares certain fisheries resources with our Pacific neighbours. We want to make sure that they boost the economic returns on such resources and over time reduce their reliance on donor nations. And given I'm the Minister of Fisheries and there's a significant amount of New Zealand money allocated to the region, and I've got some extremely well-formed views about how fisheries has to serve economic empowerment purposes, not just people wittering on about coral and sea sponges.
Tell us, what is the condition of the overall fishery? I don't know if any of us actually know. Is it sustainable going forward? Has it been wrecked and devastated? Or is nature still, you know, pumping it out?
Well, the Goldilocks zone in the Pacific is 10 degrees above and 10 degrees below the equator. And fortunately, the fishery is in great health. There's always ongoing challenges, but unlike the devastation of the cod resource off the coast of Canada over the last 20 years, this is a good news story. But as you would know, mate, anything to do with natural resources, you've got to be vigilant, and there are always players at the margin who are trying to either bend the rules or completely ignore them. So Kiwis have got a good reputation up here. We no longer have fishing vessels in the equatorial tuna resource, largely because other nations have crowded us out. There's been a substantial problem in the past. It's less of a problem now with subsidies and other such things. But in the day, Whangarei was alive with the tuna boats. The boys would go to the pub and let off a tuna bomb or three, which would completely scare the bejesus out of the local neighbourhood. But those hectic days are over. The fishery is well managed. New Zealand's got a key role to play, but we can't rest on our laurels.
Got to ask you what a tuna bomb is. Sorry to be ignorant.
Oh, well, look, it's a device that the tuna guys historically used. And it's a sort of, well, I wouldn't say harmless, but it's akin to a small incendiary device.
Oh, I got it. And like a barley cannon. We used to make barley cannons.
But we no longer. Yeah, we don't have any more boats up here any longer. We do have boats catching orange roughy, and I'm happy to share with the listeners that the New Zealand fishing industry scored some wins over the last 72 hours. In these interminable debates that dominate international fisheries, and our boats are going to be able to fish with fewer restrictions in and around the Tasman waters that separate us from Australia.
Okay, well, you heard it here, folks. Want to get on to special economic zones. We've talked, you and I, I'm sure you've talked with others as well, about the glaring, how would you call it, almost treasonous act. Let me put it that way. Some of our listeners would agree with that, of more than mothballing, but sounds like destroying our oil refinery. And we've talked about that quite a few times. And the Prime Minister's come out and said, you know, considering building another one. We've heard that. Want to get onto these special economic zones, the concept of it, I suppose around Marsden Point in this case. What is it and what difference can it make in a situation like we're in, talking about Marsden Point, for example?
Well, it's a very bleak feature of our recent economic history that we lost our refinery. It would never have happened had Winston and I still been in politics. The Labor Party green-lighted the death of the refinery. They unwisely thought that that would help save the planet. All that's done is, in my view, weaken the resilience in terms of New Zealand's fuel security. But we're in a situation where we've commissioned and completed a professional report. That report identifies it could be between $7 and $16 billion to re-establish the refinery. Well, the reality, mate, is that the refinery is currently owned privately, and you know, at any given point in the political cycle, you've got to make trade-offs, and we're struggling to rebuild the Whangarei Hospital, so I don't think the Whangarei people are going to give me a green light to spend whatever it's $4 or $5 billion, $6 billion. The figures are very large. The figures are not only accessible through the report that we commissioned, but also the Marsden Point Refinery Ownership Group and Emerald Channel. They came up with similarly large figures as well. Whether or not they're an exaggeration, you know, I'm not an engineer. So at the moment, we've settled upon promoting the creation of a zone which would increase the desirability of Marsden Point as a site for new energy innovation, energy investment, foreign direct investment in improving the range of fuels that we can rely upon to energize the economy. I'm naturally a supporter of that, with a better planning system, get rid of NIMBYism. You know, the funny thing is, mate, that this is a site that's been an industrial site for 40, 50, well, I'm 65, I'd have to say 60 years.
Hmm.
And the level of obfuscation, the level of deceit that we're witnessing coming from the green groups, that you can't do anything around the coast, or you rely on the seabed and foreshore to stop people from doing developments around the coast, including expanding the industrial estate around Marsden Point, is treacherous. I hate it, and I stand against it.
Yeah, it makes you wonder why you'd want to do that to your own country. In terms of a special economic zone, what will it actually offer? Was it offer fast tracking of things? Does it offer breaks, tax breaks, or incentives? Or is it just create a place or a space where you can be secure in laying down something that you might have to recuperate from over, what, a 50-year period, let's say?
Yeah, so these are zones that have been created in other parts of the OECD and Southeast Asia. They have a bespoke planning process where we don't go to the local government. DOC will have absolutely nothing to do with these outcomes. In fact, DOC should be removed completely from the planning system. They're a threat to ongoing economic empowerment, sadly. So in my conception of what the zones could comprise is not only bespoke planning with a senior engineer or similar person giving all the permission, but more importantly, a host of economic incentives. Now, sadly, these will represent something of a bitter pill for some interests in the broader political kind of community to swallow. I don't think that the left wing will like these zones because the economic incentives could involve state assistance, favorable tax treatment, a different set of rules, and more efficient processing of imports. Now, these things have never been tried in New Zealand, but they've been very successful in Singapore and other such places. So I'm keen to serve that up as a part of my regional development, part of my energy role, and basically say to Kiwis, look, in the event that you believe in the half of this climate change hysteria, which, as you know, I don't, we do need to simplify the route for people to invest in innovating the economy and lessening our carbon emissions. And if we're not going to take risks and have these types of approaches, then what are you going to do? What are we going to do? And if we're not going to do anything as innovative as I'm suggesting, that only further confirms my view that climate change is too often just a religion and people aren't interested in making hard choices about it.
Are there any other places in the country that have zones sort of akin to this that maybe are not officially named that way? But because I remember Trump talking about in his last term, and I think he's revived it again, economic zones for, you know, areas like Detroit and Chicago, where they've got downtrodden vast neighbourhoods, making them zones. Anything like it here?
Well, at this stage, my focus is on the strategic importance of Marsden Point. It's right. The major point of importation of fuel. It already has the deepest seaport in New Zealand. That port is expanding. It has the capacity to cope with the relocation of the Navy. We are keen to establish a dry dock facility there through our coalition agreement. So there's already a host of industrial endowments in this part of New Zealand. And I would argue that remove Marsden Point and the economy will be crippled.
So it makes more sense to operate, you just got me with the Navy there, I've heard you mention that before, more sense to operate the Navy out of a base like that, deeper port, it's not right next to a huge urban area, which would be a target, wouldn't it, in a conflict. So it makes more sense to go there.
Yeah, well, it's been a long-standing issue that our leader, Winston Peters, has pushed that the Navy be relocated from Devonport. Look, this goes back to the days of the Jim Bolger government, and each government seems to have been overwhelmed by the Admiral's wives or the cost of the relocation. I'm not sure. The reality, though, is that Devonport is an increasingly difficult place to maintain an expanded naval presence. It's although the real estate would have great value, we'd need to be very careful that any disposal of the real estate there didn't further lead to the local iwi through the treaty settlement process putting their hand up and saying that they need all the naval base for their designs, as opposed to such sites playing a significant role that benefits the overarching economy.
And in the end, it's jobs, 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 isn't it? An economic zone like you're talking about, and presumably that kind of opens the idea to other zones if it works. Jobs, right? Jobs.
Yeah, I couldn't put it any more plainly than you have. It's not only investment and it's not only enhanced planning rules, it's employment and jobs, well-paying jobs, jobs that incentivize the local academies to train a new generation of New Zealand professionals. And if we don't expand and deepen the range of opportunities in New Zealand, then our young people are going to continue to disappear overseas, and then we're going to rely upon immigration, and we certainly don't want qualified Kiwis disappearing and a new generation of Uber drivers arriving.
From a common sense point of view, your coalition partners, SENZAs, special economic zones, any part of ACT's policy thinking, do we know?
No, look, I'm sorry, I'm not aware of their sort of manifesto commitments in that regard. And I'm the first to admit, it is challenging the last 30 or 40 years of economic orthodox policy that we don't pick winners, that we don't choose areas and have bespoke interventions. But look, you know, there's two ways of looking at life, mate, and as a politician. You can be like Germans and take a consistently conservative approach and not prepare for change. Or you can be like the Yanks. Oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Let's give it a go. And I'm very much in the latter.
Well, that challenges the Kiwi way of doing things in this day and age, doesn't it?
Yeah, but we've got a confluence of factors that represent a major challenge to the New Zealand economy. We're just not generating the surplus. We're not generating the quality outcomes that are moving our cost of living equation in the right direction. boosting our productivity or indeed lessening our current account deficit. So it's not unreasonable for political parties, such as a centre-right party, a nationalist party that I belong to promote these innovations. And whether it happens in full prior to the election, or we manage to build on the momentum around the fast track, let's wait and see. But if there's one thing that proved to me that we cannot continue to hobble ourselves, it was the decision by three unelected grandees under the Resource Management Act to prevent the expansion of Northport on the basis of some hitherto unknown obscure snail living at the roots of mangrove tree.
Oh, another snail.
We're not having any of that nonsense. We're not tolerating any more of that communistic thinking.
All right, and the Prime Minister, I think, late last week said, considering rebuilding the refinery. Does that mean that, I mean, what does that mean? Is it just a, like, we're thinking about it, or
oh, well,
we're
going to, you know, we've got to, yeah, we're going to tease through the options that come from the most recent report, and obviously Cabinet will make its decisions, but I'll put it out there that it's a colossal sum of capital at a time where capital decisions are very complicated and our capacity to boost our spending is constrained. I mean, we've got a big challenge to boost our military expenditure. We want to rebuild hospitals such as Whangarei. And the Crown underwriting the recreation of the refinery has to be stacked up against those demands. And it's right and proper that a politician like myself should put those options in front of all of New Zealand.
And just to allay any fears that might be around those listening to this, in terms of screening investments, I mean, if we're really hungry and desperate, we can possibly look the other way on some things. We're not going to be doing that, right?
No, under no circumstances whatsoever. I mean, energy is at the centre of our economy's productivity, but at the same time, it's one of the most profound vulnerabilities, which is why the electricity system needs to be gutted. But sadly, I didn't get enough votes to follow that through. Had I been the energy minister, I can tell you a lot of our energy problems would have been dealt to on the 1st of December, or during December 2023. But there are a bunch of other priorities, and the gin tailors are so powerful that they've consistently got their own way. But after the next election, as God is my witness, we are breaking them up.
Wow. Okay. Again, you heard it here. Hey.
Okay.
One more. I want to get one more answer from you. When you see the speed of things that have happened in the United States just in the last month, and you compare it to the speed we do things at, what do you make of that?
Oh, it's breathtaking what Trump has done. I mean, the economy is so broad, so deep. Over 350 million people, the most resolute and robust economy in the world. I'm just gobsmacked by the pace at which things are changing. Now, there's two levels of change. There's top-line change in terms of narrative, and then there's the impact that narrative makes upon the machinery of government and the rules and regulations. But nothing but admiration for the level of not only change, but the recalibration of the direction of the narrative of their country. And there's a lot we can learn from that.
Shane Jones, Minister Oceans and Fisheries, Regional Development, Resources, Associate Minister of Finance, Associate Minister for Energy. You do a lot. Thanks for coming back on RCR, Shane, and enjoy your stay in the Solomons.
Okay, mate. Thank you for having me on your show. Bye-bye.